Can I just mention, if you don't mind, the bookstall, which of course has books by James, and it's wonderful to have Dr. White with us. And do peruse those bookstalls before you leave. My own book is there, Genesis for Today, and Genesis 1 to 11, the commentary, but also a series of DVDs on my talks, including this one, although there was only one or two copies, so they may already have gone. And if you actually are interested, my prayer list is there if you're interested in keeping in touch with the Ministry of Creation, which is increasingly, churches are recognizing the importance of this. May I just say that I don't make creation, something, oh, you must believe this for salvation. I'm fully aware that many people don't get sorted out on creation until after they become a Christian. But nevertheless, it's very important. I didn't understand inerrancy when I became a Christian. I didn't understand the infallibility of Scripture. And yet I've been so blessed by others like James and others who've instructed me over the years as to the importance of trusting in the Bible. And of course, creation, therefore, is connected with that. It's a matter of the infallibility of Scripture. And you can see why I believe that in my book, Genesis for Today, if you want to know more about the theology of creation and the position I take. It's a straightforward young earth creation position, although I'm not primarily, as you can see, speaking on that. There'll be those who perhaps don't agree with me who would still agree with this amazing, wonderful hearing that we're going to be talking about. So I want you to see that the hearing ear and the seeing eye, which the Lord says in Proverbs, he's made both of them, are just stupendous in their demonstration of the wonder of what God has done. That is what we are really showing through this. When the telegraph was first made and the telephone system, I should say, was first set up. No, it was the telegraph when they were actually getting messages across the Atlantic, to get back to the mother country and just to show who was boss. There was a wonderful statement which was sent, which was quoting from the Scripture, what God hath wrought was sent through the system. And of course, it is true of this on hearing. What God has done. It's just utterly amazing. You can hear, have you got the sound on? Your sound on. Can you hear this? Or this thing's, no, this thing's not working. Oh, it is now. I don't know whether you recognize that bird song, but that's a bird from the mother country. The mother of all. But this bird, do you recognize it? Actually, I had lots of birdsong when I opened my windows this morning. It was really delightful. But it wasn't this. This is a robin, which even the European robin sings right into the night sometimes. It's a bit like the nightingale. Utterly beautiful. So whether you're hearing birdsong or whether you're hearing speech, I am saying, as the Scripture says, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made even both of them. And in the Psalms it says, he spoke and it was, literally, he has said, and it is. The power of deity was demonstrated in Christ when he, in a moment, did things and raised people from the dead. Can you imagine Lazarus coming out of the grave? Must have been utterly stupendous to see that. A dead man has to obey his voice. And the sea on the Lake of Galilee calmed in a moment, such that the disciples said, even the winds and the waves obey him. And I really do see this in the miracle, which of course Jesus is referring to when he explains in Matthew 11 to John the Baptist as to who he is. He says, look, the blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up. And I want you to see that when Jesus actually did the miracles, he was demonstrating his deity, and some of them, of course, involved the deaf and the dumb being able to hear and to speak again. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually go through with you some of the things which are involved in hearing. I need to, of course, demonstrate to you, first of all, what is sound. And then I want to show to you how we hear, which of course is going to be the main part of this talk. And then running through it is the irreducible complexity issue. Now, I'm not going to actually, in this talk and in this presentation, and I often now don't do it, is I don't then, you know, separate it out and say, right, this is the irreducible complexity bit. I'm actually going to run the irreducible complexity argument all the way through. So I'm going to unpack that now, right? I'm going to tell you what irreducible complexity is, because this is an important issue. Because if you're dealing with a full-blown evolutionist, if you just simply say, here's this amazing thing that is working, it could be hearing, it could be sight, it could be some issue to do with a very complicated system in nature. I often speak on flight, for instance, the amazing intricacies of flight in the natural world. But he may just come back at me and say, wow, isn't evolution wonderful? So he'll have a wow factor based on his philosophy, right? So how do you counter that is the point that I'm making here. The point is that it's one thing to have a wow factor on one point, but when you actually get a whole string of things which have to be right in order for something to work, that is the argument of an irreducibly complex system. So, as I quoted to you earlier, seeing an A380 take off was actually no different to the wonder of what the Wright brothers did in 1903 on December the 17th in Kitty Hawk in North Carolina, where brilliantly these two bicycle makers, and I love to say the Smithsonian Institute, who'd poured what would be the equivalent of billions or millions at least in their day. You know, all they could do was catapult somebody on what they thought would fly, and it went straight into the Potomac twice. But these guys got it right. And how did they do it? Because they'd understood what the birds were doing. They'd understood the principles of aerodynamics in the wings. They'd understood the principles of control. And they knew that they needed a tail. Well, they actually had a sort of vertical fin at the back, but the tail was actually at the front, but we'll deal with that. But it was an amazing issue, because what they'd understood was the complexity and the irreducible complexity of controlled flight. Okay? So that demonstrates the principle that I'm making of irreducible complexity. We're going to see this principle working out with hearing. Now, you're quite free to go, wow. And I don't mind it. In fact, I'd encourage you at various places to go, wow. But remember this, that the wow doesn't prove the argument with the evolutionist. If you're going to build up an argument against a person who's a rank evolutionist, says that, you know, there's no mind behind the ear and that it just evolved, the mammalian ear is what I'm thinking of, because they say it came from reptiles, then you actually have to line up a number of things in order to show the irreducible complexity. So we need to first of all say, what is sound? Now, sound is vibration, as you can see, of molecules in the air. So there's bouncing compression waves coming from my larynx through to your ears, right? And the sound is doing this as it moves out, not only from in your direction, it's moving out in that direction, and it's even going behind me to a certain extent as well. And if I was to take all the air out of this room, apart from the fact that we've just got a little problem, you'd all be dead. But you actually wouldn't be able to hear, because you need molecules of air in order to be able to hear. You've got to have the molecules bouncing against each other in order to get a sound wave traveling at about 600 miles an hour or so through the air to you. So sound is vibration in air. Now, sound has frequency, right? And the frequency of the sound is indicated by the symbol HZ, which stands for cycles per second. So the number of in and outs per second is HZ written as cycles per cycles per second is written as HZ. That's simply after the chap called Hertz, who did a lot of work in this area. And speech, of course, is lying somewhere in the middle of the range of hearing that we have, which goes from 20 cycles per second, roughly, right up to 20,000 cycles per second. Now, when you're born, a baby can hear a little bit beyond, actually, 20,000 cycles per second. But as you're getting a bit older, like in your 20s, you're beginning to lose the upper register. Most of us won't be able to hear anymore, even in your 20s, beyond, certainly not beyond 20,000, and possibly not even up to 20,000. And when you're getting a bit older still, I'm afraid that tends to get eroded until you're getting to my ancient age, and I'm saying to my wife across the table, speak up, I can't hear you. And it may be selective hearing, of course, but I'm not quite picking up everything she says. So we actually have this great range, but it's not the greatest range in animals. Dogs will hear up to 40,000 cycles per second, and cats even up to 60,000 cycles per second. We've got little cat scarers in my garden. Oh, yeah, lost it. Don't know what happened there. Oh, back. We've got little cat scarers in my garden at home, and my grandchildren can actually hear the lower part of those cat scarers. I can't hear them at all. And, of course, that's because they have better hearing when they're younger. Now, not only is sound got a frequency, but sound, don't worry too much about the maths here or the waves and everything. Just get the general idea that sound has frequency, which is the number of vibrations per second, which, of course, is pitch for those of you who are musical. Then also sound has an amplitude, which is how much it's bouncing back and forth. Right? Now, this is where it gets important that we don't listen to music too loud or anything too loud, because we are in danger of actually hurting our ears. PA stands for Pascal. Blaise Pascal gave his name to this. And Pascals mean newtons per meter squared. For those of you who are in engineering circles, you understand what that is. And you'll recognize that as the pressure of air naturally in this room. It's somewhere around, because we're in Joburg, which is a bit lower than this. Joburg is quite high up, so it's probably quite a lot less than 100,000, but it's always in that region. And so you see that speech is a minuscule part of a vibration of that atmospheric pressure. But our ears are very sensitive to changes in pressure. If you go on a plane, sometimes the pilot doesn't always sort of get it bang on, as were particularly in the descent. And he won't put the cabin pressure up quite exactly as it should be. And you feel the air pressure changing in your ears, and you have to do this. And sometimes we blow to clear the ears so that they pop, basically, to equilibrate the pressure using the Eustachian tube, which is inside, which is connected with the throat. So we are very sensitive to pressure. Let me now just move on then to say, well, how do we hear? We talked about how we measure sound. How do we hear? Well, of course, we've got ears. You should check that you've got one on either side. And those ears are actually amazing. We have an outer ear, we have a middle ear, and we have an inner ear. Progressively, it gets more and more amazing. And there are wow factors at every single stage. The energy coming in is going to go through various changes from vibration in air to mechanical vibration of something else that I'm going to show you soon, which was then going to lead to vibration of yet another part of the ear, which is vibrating inside the inner ear, which is then going to lead to chemical energy, which is finally going to lead to electrical energy. And at every single stage, there is just a wonderful system whereby it's an almost perfect transfer of energy from one to the other. Somebody's already said wow. And quite rightly, it really is a wow factor. Your ears are actually called pinnas, right? You know, I don't know whether, I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look up the word pinna, but that's what they're called. You've got two, at least you should have two. And if you've got working ears, and I'm aware of one or two already in the audience who have already identified themselves to me, who have issues with hearing, but they give, normally when they're working, a stereo effect, which means that because I've got two, the amount of time it takes for the sound to get to this ear is slightly different to that one, which means that I can pinpoint or roughly work out where the hearing is coming, where the noise is coming from. Owls, which I'm not going to go into in depth, but they have fantastic hearing because their ears are not only displaced either side of their face, but one of them is higher than the other. And that's deliberate because the ear is that the system is basically able to get a map of all the noises because they have extremely sensitive ears. And if you take a film of an owl coming onto its prey, it like a vole or whatever it might be, a mouse at night, it actually doesn't look where it's going. It hears where it's going. And it comes down with its talons ready just to go to the exact spot that it's hearing the sound from. It's absolutely incredible. And ears and owls are very, very quiet flyers, which is yet another bit of design which I won't go into here. Now, the outer ear then is shaped in order to funnel the sound down the tube, which is the ear canal. I'm just going to have to say, though, one little bit, which is a little bit, you say, well, this is complicated, but I'll try and make it accessible for you. When you get sound coming through a tube, like a Coke bottle, if I blow over it, it makes a noise, doesn't it? It makes a particular sound. And if you blow over it carefully, you can actually get virtually a single note out of it, one pitch, right? If you put water in it, right, the note will change and it will actually go up because the natural frequency of the vibration in that tube is now different. And that's how musical instruments work. Now, the ear canal is no different. Just to show you with the resonance there of a Coke bottle, as I was demonstrating, or a guitar string, it's the same idea. But resonance has occurred in nature. And also has occurred in bridge building. As you can see, here's the narrows in... where was it now? Sorry? Tacoma. Tacoma Narrows Bridge famously collapsed. I always want to know what happened to that car, whether it actually ended up in the water or not, but it never shows you the last bit. But it broke. And that bridge was vibrating because of a natural frequency, right? So we have a natural frequency in the ear. Another example would be a glass which naturally wants to vibrate. I've just talked about a Coke bottle vibrating. Well, a glass is much more delicate. So when that starts vibrating, if the amplitude goes up sufficiently, it breaks the glass. So this is the concept of a musical instrument. You change the holes which are open and you get different sounds from a flute, or of course you can do it from a guitar string as well. Well, now look at the ear canal. The ear canal is not just a hole. It is small, and of course it's smaller than your little finger, which is not a bad thing anyway, because you then might be in danger of scraping your eardrum apart. And you have to be very careful if you put something down that ear canal that you don't puncture the eardrum at the end. And it resonates, though, amazingly at 4,000 cycles per second. And this is a staggering point. You see, what I'm going to say mainly today is about mammals being different to reptiles. But within the mammals, human ears are different to dog ears and are different to cat ears because the vibrations which we naturally amplify because of this 2-centimeter roughly ear canal is different to the vibrations that a dog will amplify or a cat will naturally amplify. So do you see that the actual detail of the wavelength and everything for those who follow this in more detail is there if you want it. But what it actually shows to us is that there is a natural sensitivity in our ears to speech. So not a very good diagram, apologies, but I haven't got a better one at the moment. But the ear of a cat actually has a right angle. And as you can see, there is a narrowing at that point. And it's this bit which is naturally vibrating at a much higher frequency. So cats very easily hear a very high frequency, and dogs also hear a different frequency range naturally to us. They hear all the noises we hear, but it's what they particularly are in tune to, right? They amplify the very, very high frequencies, which is why when you're halfway down the road approaching your house, okay, and somebody, maybe you're with the family and dad is coming down the road, the dog starts barking immediately because it's hearing much more sensitively than we do. And it's hearing which is the issue. Smell as well, of course, they've got tremendous sense of smell, but assuming dad is not, you know, too smelly, it's actually the hearing which is going on. Sorry. Being a bit rude to dads, but there we go. Let me just tell you something else, though. Quite amazingly, our ears are sensitive at this frequency range to water flowing. And so much of our experience in nature is the beauty in hearing of water. How much we love to go to a wonderful stream in Great Britain, or I'm sure you have them here as well, of course you do, right across Africa. You have wonderful sights, wonderful waterfalls, and we just love, some of us just love, just sitting there. Oh, you know, we really relax when you've got water flowing. In fact, people deliberately sometimes have sound generators with water in order to get them to sleep. Did you know that air bubbles are what makes that sound? It's air bubbles which get trapped in the water and then pop, right? Now, when you're hearing this water and this river, it is literally thousands of little air bubbles. You can actually hear in this sound, pop, 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 pop. And it's the air bubbles which are popping, always at this frequency, which lies bang in that sound range for speech, okay? And when you're sitting on, maybe, I don't know where you go sometimes, to the coast, Cape Town or Durban, and you see these massive waves roaring onto the beach, and it does it, of course, in England a lot, and wow, it's a fantastic sight, and the sound of these waves breaking on the shore. It's literally billions of little air bubbles all popping together that make that roar. And we love it because there is a sense of appreciation of nature. Our ears are made for appreciating beauty, but you're going to see this a bit more as we go on. If you want to find out more, watch this BBC documentary. The BBC do get it right sometimes. And this is a wonderful documentary on the secret life of waves. They love having secret life in their titles. They're always going on about secret there. Anyway, but now let me move on to the middle ear. The middle ear, of course, just have that diagram, is that bit in the middle, which is the eardrum. And now we're going into amazing little bones, which all mammals have, not just us. And we're going to look at the way those operate. They are connected to the tympanic membrane, which is the eardrum, and they are three little bones which are levering together, okay? The tympanic membrane is connected to a hammer, which the technical term for it is the malleus. Then it's connected to, the technical term is the incus, but it's actually loosely called the anvil because it's shaped like an anvil. And then lastly, it's connected to a stirrup. The technical term for it is the stapes. And what you've got is a connection going from vibration in air through to vibration mechanically of three little bones. There's a 10-cent piece. It's a dime. Is that right, James? Yes, it's a dime. Always get your money confused anyway. So I constantly have to translate it from Monopoly money to real money. And of course, the real money is going downhill at the moment anyway, as you probably know, ever since we Brexit and all the rest of it. But these three little bones are the same size when you were born as to when you will die, right? Now, that's an important point. I was at a university here in South Africa where I was had an audience who wasn't exactly very sympathetic, and somebody interrupted me because I said, just at this point, I said, these three bones are reckoned to come from reptiles. But reptile bones constantly grow, growing, growing, growing. A crocodile is growing, 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 including its jaw. And yet the evolutionist says that the rear bone of the lower jaw and the rear bone of the upper jaw became the hammer and the anvil to actually add to the existing stapes in a reptile ear to change it into a mammalian ear. But I said, just a minute, reptile bones are constantly growing. You're trying to propose, or an evolutionist is trying to propose, that these bones which are constantly growing then moved into the inner, in the middle ear of what was to become a mammal. The problem is that you've got something which is constantly growing and has now got to become not constantly grow, plus the fact that the size of these bones is very, very important. Well, you could have heard a pin drop when I started doing this, because he then got up, said, or we interrupted my talk. He didn't get up immediately. We interrupted my talk and said, please keep your personal opinions to yourself and keep to the science. I said, please tell me, what of what I just said is not science? He refused to answer and walked out of the room with his, you know, shut his computer very firmly and walked out. It's a very sad fact that many people just will not engage on the actual observational science. The reptile ear is very different and doesn't have these extra two bones, which you can see here. And the shape of these is absolutely crucial, because what you've got here is a movement such that as the hammer goes like this, the anvil is going like this, okay? So it's actually an amplification system. So you've got to get the shape right, because this hammer is actually moving against the incus, right? The hammer is moving against the anvil. And at the end, you've got this stapes, which is literally acting like a piston, right? The piston is going in and out. And this movement is more than this movement. So actually, if you work out the energy, for those of you who are engineers here, the energy in the system is roughly proportional to the area times the movement, right? So it's a large area here times a small movement, which is going to be a small area times a large movement. So roughly the energy is about the same. And it's an almost perfect transmission device. And these things don't come about by accident, guys. You've got to design them. And this is just simply a superb mechanical transmission device from vibration in air to vibration in liquid, because that's where we're going. And it's a piston is absolutely essential to get a vibration into liquid. If I get a bicycle pump, right, and I pull the handle out, put my finger over the end and push the handle in, will I be able to get some travel? You're not are you an engineer? All right, I need an engineer here, or somebody will I be able to get some travel? You obviously haven't pumped your bicycle tires up recently, yeah?
You still want a finger.
Yeah, I've got a finger over one end, right? Over the end where the air's coming out. Will I be able to push the handle in? Oh, you still say no. Who says no? Who says yes? Yes, I've got real engineers behind you. You can push it down, but not very far. But you can push it a distinct amount. Because air... I'm going to use a technical term here, but I'll explain it. Air is compressible, right? Air can be pushed in and out. You wouldn't use air in a hydraulic system. I'm sure maybe they do use air in Los Angeles for the pulpit. I don't know, but I'm sure it wouldn't work. But you use liquid in a hydraulic system, because if I was to put water into that bicycle pump, right, push the handle down, put the end into water, right, pull the handle back up, full of water. I got a lovely water pistol, I know, but we'll forget that for a moment. Put your finger over the end. Would I be able to push the handle down? And the answer is no. Minuscule, but basically no. Because water and all liquids are, you're looking glazed, Tim. just that look. But liquid is incompressible. It's always got to have somewhere to go. So if I push against the liquid here, it's got to go somewhere, right? And so this is a system deliberately made to transfer vibration in air into a piston, which is pushing against the liquid, which is pretty heavy compared with the air. You know that full well, don't you? If you get a bucket of air, it doesn't weigh much at all, right? But if you get a bucket of water, it weighs a lot. So air actually is heavy, does have a weight, but liquid is much heavier. So now look, friends, we now come to the cochlea, which is the inner ear. Now, when we look at this cochlea, it is frankly superb engineering. Already, we've had just brilliant engineering with this mechanical device of the three little bones. Remember, they don't change their size from when you're born to when you die. So that in itself is one wow factor. So you could all say together, wow, on that one. But we're going to get into an even more of a wow factor when we now come to the inner ear. And the inner ear, the stirrup is coming onto what we call the oval window. But any engineer looking at this will say, this is the mark of design. Because there is a round window there. The round window is absolutely essential. It's a little it's really like a little bit of skin, which is actually moving out when this one moves in. Right? It's a little membrane which is vibrating in sympathy, but always the other way around. If I now play these two videos, you can see that as the stirrup goes in, this round window comes out the other direction, right? So it's always taking account of the pressure, which is increasing in the cochlea, but the liquid, instead of, you know, just saying, oh, I've got to go somewhere, I'll break the cochlea, it actually takes account of that by coming against the little round window to take account of the pressure. Now, I also want you to just see on this video, which demonstrates it much better, the movement of these three little bones against each other. There is the malleus, the incus, and the stapes. And now if you watch here, as the stirrup is going in, you'll see in a moment that this round window goes in the other direction. Okay, this is an amazing system. Now, as this round window, as the oval window is compressed, then you'll find that one ventricle is actually pressurized, it's the cochlear duct, and then the return pressure comes down the tympanic duct. So the cochlear duct takes the pressure initially, then it goes right down to the end of the cochlea, then it comes back up the other duct. There are three ducts in the cochlea. If you think this is getting complicated, it's nothing compared with what I'm going to end with. So you need to stay with me, guys. But this bit is frankly on its own amazing, because we're now going to unravel the cochlea. You'll have seen, if I just go back just a bit, if you'll have seen, if I go back there, that here there was a little membrane. That little membrane is called the basilar membrane. B-A-S-I-L-A-R, the basilar membrane. And a lot of this was really only discovered in the last 50 years or so to actually understand how this works. As the sound comes in, the sound that I'm making is actually coming in coming into your ears with a number of frequencies. My basic voice is probably somewhere in 400 or 500 cycles per second or somewhere in that region, the basic lower part. But the speech part is all on top of that, okay? So it's a mixture of frequencies. When any one of you is speaking, I can perhaps recognize, if I've met you before, that is, I can recognize your voice because I'm listening not only to the speech, but I'm listening to the modulation of the speech, all the other frequencies with it. So what I want you to see is that we've just got one pure frequency coming in. And the basilar membrane is like an xylophone. Really, it is like an xylophone. Because it's tapering. It's its width is different one end to the other. Now, does anybody admit it? You've played with an xylophone, even recently, maybe with some cousins or maybe with your grandchildren. But you bounce along with your 4 or 5 year old, whatever child in your family, and you play twinkle, twinkle, little star. Come on, admit it. You do it. And you can do it on an xylophone with you know, different size keys, don't you? The big one is the lower C, and the top one is top C, right? And then you've got all these notes in between. And the basilar membrane is exactly like that, except that the basilar membrane is so sensitive that if somebody is playing A, right, on a piano, it immediately starts vibrating in sympathy at the appropriate location. But if somebody plays a different note, like middle C, then a different part starts vibrating. So it's like a little gremlin in your inner ear is playing the different notes which are coming in from the outside world. Well, if you think that's wonderful, now, yes, there's a wow factor here. And let me just play this video for you to just get another aspect of what I've just said.
The cochlea now uncoils, and we look at the basilar membrane, and now see what happens when we play individual tones. Now a chord. And finally, something really complex.
Appreciate all sorts of sounds immediately. We have a perfect frequency analyzer. For the engineers here, you actually have a perfect analog frequency analyzer. If you don't know what the word analog means, I mean as against digital. So you don't need even a millisecond of the signal to be able to analyze using the basilar membrane. You don't need any length at all of that signal. As soon as that signal starts, it's split into its frequencies. Another way of putting it, again for the engineers here, is that you've got a perfect way of going from the time domain into the frequency domain. And engineers often need to do that. We talk about fast Fourier transforms and things like that, which I won't go into or bore you with all the detail. But that is really what's going on here. It's an amazingly simple and yet profoundly complicated system. It looks simple, but of course it's profound because you're actually connecting this with those three little bones which are coming in, which are causing sloshing of this liquid, which is actually causing the basilar membrane to vibrate. But we ain't finished yet, guys. There's more to come. Just to really emphasize this, I want you to see that our ears are built for listening to fine frequency changes, which, of course, are always involved in music. And I've cheated here. I've used a sonic visual analyzer in order to simulate what the ear is doing. So, if you like, this is the basilar membrane or the equivalent of it. And we're going to look at vibrations going upward, which indicates that that note is resonating. Okay? So, first of all, we'll look at a particular note, one note, then another note, and another note. And then we'll look at a chord, right? So you're able to hear a chord, right? But of course, your ears are so finely tuned and in one sense over-designed, because we don't really need all this just to survive. You probably only really need maybe to resolve maybe 5 cycles per second, but you've got such wonderful resolution in your ears that you can appreciate music. So let's play some and simulate what's going on in your ear. We're going to play that wonderful piece, Dances with the Wolves. So what you are seeing now is each of the frequencies as it were, of the little gremlin playing the notes in your ear, which are vibrating in sympathy with the main notes, which is B flat, just had. So now we're on to C, but we've got all the harmonies playing with it, which gives the richness in our appreciation of sound. So we have the ability with our ears, when they're working properly, to actually appreciate deeply the music, which many of us love very greatly. Well, if you thought that was wonderful, we still haven't got to the bottom of hearing. We might well ask the question, why are our ears so wonderfully over-designed? Because the evolutionist has to explain, why do we need to listen to music with such fine resolution? Because you've got a nerve for every single frequency, which I'm going to show you soon, is connected to another aspect of the inner ear. Let me now just summarize where we've got to. You've got the vibration of the eardrum, the three little bones doing their work there, the vibration of the oval window and the circular window in sympathy in the other way, and then the basilar membrane vibrating at a particular frequency. The high frequency is at the bottom, and the low frequencies are hidden inside. So we can hear right down to actually 20 cycles per second, right up when we're born to 20,000. Now I'm going to slice through one bit of the cochlea. So this is actually in a great big spiral, and we've actually sliced through. Please notice that you've got the two other canals down which the pressure of the liquid goes and then comes back up, okay? But I didn't mention, because it was a special compartment which I was going to come to, which is the cochlear duct. This is full of endolymph, which is electrically charged. So this is an electrically charged compartment. So it's rather like water, but it's a bit like electrolyte in the car battery, right? It's got ions, right? So it's got charged particles in there. And you've got the basilar membrane there, and on the other side, it's not shown here, but there is another membrane which this is going to get pushed against, and it's the organ of Corti. I'm going to skip that picture and go straight to this one, because this picture shows that there is the basilar membrane at the bottom, the tectoral membrane above, and there is tiny little hairs there which are now going to be the focus of my attention for the next few minutes. What happens when this organ of Corti, which is right next to the basilar membrane, when that is pushed? This is what happens. I'm going to show you on this video again, another part of this video. There's the air pressure or the water pressure coming round the other two ducts. But then I want you to see in here, can you see? This is the organ of Corti, which is being pushed up by the basilar membrane against the tectoral membrane above. And it's what those hairs are doing, which I'm now going to describe. This really is a wow factor. Because these hairs are so tiny that 72 of them would actually reach the width of a human hair. I've got some hairs, just a few left on my head, but if you don't mind, I'm not going to pluck them out because they're very precious. I don't think the Lord spends much time counting my hair, right? But you could get 72 stereocilia, which is what these are called, lined up one to the other, and you just get to the width of a human hair. These are utterly tiny, but are absolutely amazing in what they do. Now get this, they come in pairs, which is why they're called stereocilia, right? And when they get pushed up against the tectoral membrane, right, they are turned over sideways. And as they go turned over sideways, there is literally a mechanical spring attached to the top of one hair and attached to near the top of its adjacent partner. And this tiny, tiny little spring is attached to a trap door, you could say wow if you wish, which opens and down which the ions, which are electrically charged molecules, electrically charged molecules of calcium and potassium in particular, they then go down through that trapdoor, down the hair, and they excite the nerve with an electrical current, which then goes to the brain. That is just stupendous. And when you actually listen to one particular frequency, then the stereo cilia for that particular frequency, because we're just going through one slice of the cochlea, then that particular frequency has its own little hairs which are being pushed against the tectoral membrane and down which the potassium ions are coming and exciting the nerve at the bottom. So you have some nerves for 400 cycles per second. Then you have another set of another nerve for 401 cycles per second, and then 402, and then 403. Now, most of us can't even distinguish between 400 and 401 and 402, but some people who are very, very good at hearing musically perhaps can. But our ears are so, so wonderfully made that we can resolve these different frequencies. It is true that once you get up to about 15,000 or 10, certainly above 10,000 cycles per second, it begins to go one nerve per every 3 cycles per second. So 1,000, then 1,003, and so on. But we have wonderful ability to actually distinguish different sounds. And then, of course, we have to ask the question, well, how do we then hear the different sounds in our brain? By the way, the reason I got involved in this is because my whole work has been, for a lot of my working life, was in combustion, and I was looking at pressure waves as they interacted with flames. And so some flames are actually very sensitive to sound, and they actually will vibrate due to sound because there is an interaction between pressure and combustion, and it can even make engines go wrong. So that's why I've got interested in acoustics and pressure waves without, of course, combustion with your ears. At least I've never put a candle to my ear. I don't intend to. But, you could see why I ended up looking at this, and I could see that it was an amazing system. Let me just show you this picture, and then I'll wrap it up. I want to actually show you that this is the spiral ganglion nerve, which is attached to every little bit of the cochlea. So again, we've sliced through the cochlea there. And these nerves then go to different parts of the brain, depending whether it's speech or whether it's music. So our brains are so sensitive that the sound, if it's coming from a person I know, will immediately be picked up with one part of the brain to do with speech. But if it's music, it goes to another part of the brain. And of course, if it's your well-beloved, it's both, isn't it? So we have an amazing system. And I think we really do need to say, what has God wrought? Now, I need to just wrap it up in 2 points. I need to point out that we also have a balance system very close to our inner ear, which also has little cilia, but are not used for sound, but are used for balance. And we have 3 semicircular canals, one which is horizontal, one which is vertical that way around, and vertical that way around. So if I'm moving around like this, I can sense it even with my eyes closed initially because of the horizontal one, okay? Or if I'm tipping over one way, right, I can sense that I'm out of balance because of this one. Or if I'm tipping over this way, I can actually sense that. And if I stand on one leg, right, then I'm using my balance system. I should be. I'm still able to do it by these little little things here, I'm going to fall over in a minute, all working, right, with the cilia in them. Some people get Meniere's disease, and it's a nasty disease. They get an infection of the ear, which then spreads to these other semicircular canals, and they get vertigo. They can't even get out of bed, you know, can't stand up straight. It's a horribly debilitating disease. Now, these things actually also show us something else, because when it comes to apes, and in particular when it comes to the so-called claim that Lucy is one of our ancestors, which I would deny completely, it's actually an ape. You can tell immediately from the hand bones, you can tell from the length of the humerus and also the radius and the ulna. You can tell immediately when you go and see the reconstruction, which is still there in Addis Ababa Museum of Lucy, and the Americans actually have the originals. I don't know what happened there. It's not for me to comment. I'm not quite sure why they ended up in the States. But anyway, when you look at Lucy, you can see whether from the reconstructed or the original bones, it was an ape. But I tell you this, you can also tell from the ear. The inner ear, and the part that I'm talking about, which is the bit for balance. Dr. Fred Spohr has done CAT scans of the inner ear region of some of these skulls. These show that the semicircular canals, which determine balance and ability to walk upright, resemble that of the extant great apes. Not extinct, the extant, those ones still existing today. Now, I tell you what he's done. Think of the horizontal one, right? An ape doesn't normally walk with its head like that, even when it's walking bipedally, right? Walking with two legs, which they do, it will be stooped because its head's like this. And so its natural point for its horizontal ear canal is like that, such that if you were to put the skull rather like ours, you would see immediately, just by looking at the ear canal, hey, that's an ape. And that's what people have done. That's what he's referring to. When did the BBC ever tell me that? When did CNN ever tell me that? Or Fox News, or I don't know what the equivalent is in South Africa. It's just, it's never told you, is it? People never put this in the education classes. And it really gets my blood red, boiling, when I see that people are misled in terms of the evidence. I just need to end on one second point, and that's this. This is what the evolutionist will say. He will say that the rear bone of the upper jaw of a reptile and the rear bone of the lower jaw have actually gone to the incus, or to form the incus and the malleus, that is the anvil and the hammer, respectively, in mammals. It all sounds such a wonderful idea, doesn't it? But really, there is nothing to support it. I say nothing, to be fair. They do line up what they call synapsid fossils, which are mammal-like reptiles, which are found in the rocks. I personally don't believe in the timescales that they use, but even if I did, I think it's just a story. I think those fossils are primarily from the flood, but that's my personal position. But even if you were to actually line them up, it's simply a story of extinct creatures, where they try to say that the ear, which is very, very close to the jaw for some of these mammal-like reptiles, which we don't have today. Well, so what? So that just means that in the past, there were creatures which had somewhat different ear systems. And we still got some which are very similar to that. One in particular is the duck-billed platypus, which actually has characteristics which some people say looks like a mammal, other people say, no, it looks like a reptile, and other ones, actually looks like a bird because of its beak. But it's just very happy in its own particular class and, you know, does what it does do very well. Thank you. And its ears are actually in that sort of stage where you'd say, well, are they quite mammal or are they quite reptile? But it's working. And that's the only point, that they were just designed that way. That's what it really shows. You see, Richard Dawkins admits this in his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, where he says the lower jaw, single bone in mammals, the reptilian lower jaw is more complicated and thereby hangs a fascinating tale that I reluctantly omitted from this book. In an amazing feat of evolutionary legerdemain, I'll come back to that. The smaller bones of the reptilian jaw were co-opted into the mammalian ear. Sounds amazing, doesn't it? Where they constitute an exquisitely delicate bridge to transport sound from the eardrum to the inner ear. That last statement is certainly correct, but all the rest, what on earth is he saying? Because he says and admits in his own words, legerdemain. Well, when I looked up legerdemain, it means sleight of hand. A synonym would be artfulness, chicanery, conjuring, craftiness, cunning, deceit, deception, hocus pocus, I like that, manipulation, trickery. Right, it's his own words. Now, Brian Cox, who's meant to be sort of the up-and-coming replacement for David Attenborough, said this in his program, The Wonders of Life. So I'd like to play you this to end with.
As continued. Around 210 million years ago, the first mammals evolved. And unlike our friends, the reptiles here, mammals have a jaw that's made of only one bone. A reptile's jaw is made of several bones fused together. So that freed up two bones, which moved and shrank and eventually became the malleus, the incus, and stapes. So this is the origin of those three tiny bones that are so important to mammalian hearing.
If you've got to resort to a flick book to prove your point, I think there's something wrong. I personally do not regard that as anything like proper observational science. It's a story being overlaid on the evidence. Far better to believe what the scriptures actually say, which the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord, has made, even both of them. And when it comes to the human ear, I think we should agree with the psalmist who says, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows right well. I believe the argument from design is a very powerful argument. But please remember what I said at the beginning, that you don't just simply take one, as it were, magic bullet of one little part. The argument of irreducible complexity is the most powerful argument in design, that nothing will work unless everything works. I've had the privilege during my time of doing these talks to meet all sorts of people all over the world. And even today I've met someone who has a cochlear implant. Now, the cochlear implant required a huge amount of medical engineering. It began with a surgeon from Melbourne who did the first cochlear implant. And I met two people in Melbourne, actually, who'd been helped and enabled to hear. They couldn't hear at all. One of them couldn't hear anything. But now he can hear. Now they're moving towards actually attaching not just, say, 100 nerves such you could hear speech, but now attaching many, many more nerves in between, going directly from the microphone here, right in through the beyond the cochlear to the nerves in the spiral ganglion nerves, and actually enabling music to be heard as well. Now that, of course, has to have such sophisticated, careful surgeon doing it, a person who really knows what he's doing. And it really shows and gives the lie to the idea that the mammal ear had somehow evolved by chance from a reptile system, which is simply hearing low frequencies in the main and doesn't need that amplification for high frequencies. I think you'll agree with me that the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made even both of them. Thank you. Well, exactly. I didn't mention, and I should have mentioned, that when you listen to loud music, I meant to say it actually, I forgot to say it, that when you listen to loud music, if you listen to one particular frequency very loud, you're in danger of snapping those little springs. And some people actually, when they are in a in an environment, in an industry. Sometimes it's not their fault, but they haven't been given ear defenders and they've listened to a repetitive sound of a steam turbine or whatever, and they've lost the hearing in that particular frequency range. So it's a very sad fact, but sometimes we're a bit foolish with listening to very loud music. We do need to be very careful. You are right, even though you're making a joke of it. It is actually an important point.